Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Sunday is Charter Day in Pennsylvania, marking the anniversary of when William Penn was granted a charter from the King of England in 1681 for a new territory in North America. What many of us know about Penn is he was a Quaker, a religious group that had suffered persecution in Great Britain, and Penn wanted his colony, Pennsylvania, to be a place where people could worship freely, to a degree. But there's much more to the story of Penn than that, and his background came to shape Pennsylvania. Joining us today is Dr. Andrew Murphy. He's author of the new book, William Penn, A Life. Dr. Murphy, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for having me on. I'm looking forward to being out there on Sunday afternoon in person.
I wanted to mention that Dr. Murphy will be speaking about William Penn, the book, at the State Museum in Harrisburg, Sunday starting at 2 o'clock, also signing some of the books. If you have a question or comment about William Penn, Pennsylvania's founder, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at Smart Talk WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Murphy, we Pennsylvanians haven't heard much about William Penn other than the highlights, which I just kind of read off in my introduction. Why don't we know more about Penn?
Well, he's an interesting character. One of the things I'm going to be talking about on Sunday afternoon are things that we wish we knew more about. One thing that really I think is worth pointing out is he actually spent a relatively small amount of time in America, in Pennsylvania. He spent 37 years as proprietor of the colony, but only spent 4 years on the site, on the ground here, two visits of 2 years each, separated by 15 years. So despite the fact that his name is everywhere, and he's on the statue up on City Hall in Philadelphia. He's all over the murals in the State House out in Harrisburg. He was a bit of a stranger to the people in the colony, even while he was alive.
Why is it that he spent so little time here in Pennsylvania?
Well, the title of my talk on Sunday is Four Mysteries, Things We Wish We Knew More About, or Things That People Often Don't Know Much About, and that will be the third mystery. Before he received the property of Pennsylvania, he was an active political figure in England, trying to achieve liberty of conscience for Quakers and other religious dissenters. And that, of course, led him, because of the kind of connections he had, that led him to Pennsylvania. He was involved in a series of border disputes over what we currently know as the state of Delaware with the Maryland colony. So he went back after the first 2 years to deal with that conflict. And at that point, he got sort of sucked back into English politics, which was where he had been before he was in America. So he became very close to King James II of England, who also wanted to bring about religious toleration. And in some ways, he was born and raised in England, and he remained an Englishman in some ways. His center of gravity, you might say, was in England. So he ended up being gone for 15 years, returned again briefly for a couple of years, and then I went back to England, and he never returned.
Mm. You mentioned, I'm going to jump around a little bit on you here, but you're not going to go chronologically in William Penn's life, but you mentioned the dispute with Lord Baltimore in Maryland. The lower counties of what was considered Pennsylvania, that Maryland also claimed, what is now Delaware, that this almost came to violence, that Maryland and Pennsylvania, I don't know if I'd go as far as saying they almost went to war, but
they did go to war, but
it almost became a civil war between Maryland and Pennsylvania over this dispute. Explain what happened and why there was such a dispute over the land.
Well, it's an enormously complicated. We'd be here all morning just trying to give you all the details. It's an enormously complicated question that has to do with maps that are drawn in England, maps of America, some of them drawn by people who haven't been to America. Where is the 40th parallel? And all of these things. But when Penn was granted the land of Pennsylvania, he desperately wanted what you, as you referred to, the lower counties, Newcastle, Kent, and Sussex, which is obviously the current state of Delaware. Because if you look at a map, you see that Delaware Bay is the access point to the Atlantic Ocean, And on a number of different maps, the specific locations of things are in dispute. If Penn had lost the dispute with Baltimore, it's possible that Philadelphia would have found itself within the boundaries of Maryland, which would have been a complete disaster for Penn. So it was extremely important situation, geographical situation of those counties. Maryland wanted them, Pennsylvania wanted them, and Penn actually won the case. But after he won the case, he really wanted to make sure everything was nailed down. And that's the point, as I was mentioning a few minutes ago, that he sort of found himself drawn back into English politics and then again spent the next decade or so in England.
You touched on this, but what Penn wanted almost desperately was for his new colony to have access to the ocean, that there would be a port there. Now, didn't end up that way because, with Philadelphia and the Delaware River being a port and being an important port in American history, but it wasn't exactly on the ocean. But so he won, but he didn't get exactly what he wanted.
Right, and also the legal appeals went on and on. I mean, we're really talking about this isn't settled until the Mason-Dixon line is finally run in the the second half of the 18th century. So the after the original interlocutors passed from the scene, the families continue this. So it really does go go on into the 18th century.
Now, there was a bit of a dispute also with, maybe a bit of a dispute is an understatement, but with New York as well. Now, it didn't rise to the level of with Lord Baltimore and Maryland, but Penn wanted Upper Susquehanna Valley. The Susquehanna Valley was important to him, too, because of fur trading. Talk about that dispute, if you would.
Sure, that was another very important piece of the puzzle. He desperately wanted to get involved in the fur trade. The New York authorities desperately wanted to keep it for themselves. Albany really was one of the important the way the various trade routes went. The governor of New York, Thomas Dongan, and Penn both shared a close relationship with James, who later became King James II. So that, I think, helped this dispute from really kind of spiraling out of control. But it was very much a conflict over territory, over profit, and over who was going to control that particular part of the state, part of the land.
Penn's father, now I am going to go back in William Penn's life a little bit. Penn's father, Sir William Penn, he was a naval hero in Britain and a man who was held in high regard. I have to say that it's not surprising that as William Penn's father, he had a great influence on his oldest son. But it also had some influence on William Penn's social standing, and that seemed to help or at least aid Penn throughout his life, correct?
Absolutely. Particularly after he became a Quaker, which was in many ways a career-ending move. It removed him from the ability to hold office, to continue studying at university, a whole range of things that were kind of off-limits to you if you forsook the established church. But because his father was not only a naval man, but a very savvy political Navy man. He served on the parliamentary side during the Civil War in the 1640s, and then became a close friend of the king, the other side, when they brought the king back in 1660. And so his connections, his not only his political connections, but his close personal connections with the royal family, especially with King Charles II, who was the king who actually granted the charter that's going to be on display on Sunday. So his father really navigated personal connections for William that were able to maintain his position of authority and influence even when he chose an extremely unpopular religious community to associate himself with.
Now, Sir William Penn was not thrilled with his son becoming a Quaker, converting to becoming a Quaker. As you mentioned, the Quakers were persecuted in Britain. And by persecuted, we mean they went to jail. William Penn went to jail for you know, talking on the street, some of his writings, that kind of thing. Just a couple things in the book that you mentioned. Quakers would not doff their hats when greeting someone. They wouldn't swear an oath. You know, today we hear those things and think, okay, it's a sign of disrespect. But in England at that time, this meant a little bit more than just disrespect, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it was considered seditious, treasonous. It sort of shook, or it threatened to shake, a whole set of social and political hierarchies and religious hierarchies. The refusal to acknowledge and properly respect your superiors was akin to violating the Fifth Amendment, honor your parents. So this was not simply just adopting some unconventional beliefs, but there were a whole range of practices that went along with it that made Quakers, even to people who were, say, you know, Presbyterians or Baptist, sort of non-Anglicans, the Quakers were considered to be absolutely extreme and deeply troubling.
Penn was thrown in jail for his religious beliefs, and not just any jail, but thrown in jail at the Tower of London.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he had three or four imprisonments, really, in his 20s. In the first few years, when he first became a Quaker, he had you know, the zeal of a convert. He spent a number of months in the Tower of London. The king would send his personal chaplain to Penn's cell to try to talk him out of his heresies. Unsuccessfully, I should add. And so, yes, as you mentioned, the persecution included imprisonment, included whipping. Not Penn himself was not whipped, and his, I think, social standing helped that. But certainly there were fines. Quakers were subject to all sorts of gruesome physical punishments. It was a very serious. They were considered to be a very serious subversive threat.
Why? Why were they considered to be such this subversive threat?
Well, from the things you just mentioned, I mean, again, as you pointed out, we think of, oh, you're not going to doff your hat for someone. Well, that's slightly impolite. But it really was taken to be a refusal to comport oneself in the way that civilized people comported themselves, and a refusal to recognize hierarchies of education, of social standing and so on, and it was considered to be something that really threatened the structure of society. Again, it can be hard for us to put ourselves back into that sort of mindset, but it was not simply, oh, those people have different beliefs. It's that they have beliefs that if they're allowed to continue and allowed to openly exist, they really threaten the nature of society as we know it.
Penn wrote a lot about his religious beliefs, but he also was critical, and some might go as far as saying he was very anti-Catholic, called it papism or popism. Talk about, first of all, why was he anti-Catholic, and why did he kind of pick on Catholicism?
Well, he picked on everyone. One of the things about the early Quakers is that they were, and we tend to have a view of Quakers as quiet and peaceful and pacifistic and so on, and of course they are. Early Quakers were extremely disruptive. They were convinced, as were many other groups at the time, that they had the right answers and others didn't, and they wanted to let them know that. Now, with regard to Catholics, the English sort of across the board were deeply anti-Catholic. There's the theological objections on the one hand, but there's really a political objection here, which is the assumption that Catholics would be, by definition, disloyal English citizens, that they owed their allegiance to the Pope and not the King, and that they were a kind of a subversive threat. In fact, Quakers were often accused of being Catholics in disguise. Now, Penn was deeply critical of Catholic religion, as you were pointing out, for a whole range of different reasons that sort of mirror standard Protestant critiques of Catholicism, its subservience to the Pope and things like that. What he consistently tried to do was to find a way to allow loyal Catholic citizens to have the liberty of their worship, if there could be some way to ensure that they would be loyal. So he had came up with a various with various sort of affirmations that could be given to Catholics and so on. But in terms of being critical of Catholicism as a religion, he certainly was. He was critical of lots of religions. I think what sets him apart a bit is that he was open to the idea that that some solution could be found that could enable them to worship and yet ensure their loyalty. And I think the thing that really drives this is his increasingly close personal friendship with King James II, as I was saying, who was himself Catholic.
Mm. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Check out upcoming topics for Smart Talk at WITF.org/smarttalk. You can see some of the shows that we're working on, such as a group of surgeons providing care overseas in some of the poorest areas of the world, PBS's Judy Woodruff, and how the media covered the Three Mile Island accident in 1979. We invite you to share your questions in advance by sending us a voice memo or leaving voicemail. See what's coming up at WITF.org/smarttalk. But today we're talking about a new biography out called William Penn, A Life, about the founder of Pennsylvania. The author is Andrew Murphy. He also teaches at Rutgers University. He will be appearing at the State Museum in Harrisburg on Charter Day, Sunday at 2 p.m. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalk. WITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's go to Tony in Lancaster on the phone. Tony, you're on the air. Hi,
yeah,
Tony.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, great. I was working. I had it on speaker. Hey, I just wanted to, I don't have anything to say about the controversial particularly, but no, this was a really great book on William Penn. I'm a Quaker, and I'm interested in Pennsylvania history for other kind of reasons. I mean, this book, I mean, congrats. That was I've read a lot of books on William Penn. They tend to be, you know, what do you call it, hagiography, some of them. And but this book really allowed, gave me a really great overview, not just of the history of Quakers. It's kind of strange how they turned from so radical into a pretty organized religion during William Penn's lifetime. So from a Quaker point of view, I knew that, but this gave a lot of detail about that. The history of Pennsylvania is very complicated. We live around here in Lancaster and stuff, and you go to this site or the other. But as Murphy was saying, I mean, it was incredibly complex. You had the governor, you had the Board of Trade, who knew how important that had been, Penn's money problems. So I just want to say, I would just like to say, anybody who has any interest in the history of Pennsylvania, or that much lesser group of people who have an interest in Quaker history, this is a great book.
Tony's...
Oh, and by the way, Quakers,
thank you so much.
If you think that that's not totally over, try not standing up during the national anthem at a Penn State game.
Oh, I'll bet. Hey, Tony, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Murphy, you have to be glad to hear that.
Yes, I had nothing to do with setting up that call, I promise.
But he did touch on several areas that you write about in the book, and I'm sure a lot of people who know or are knowledgeable about Pennsylvania's history can learn something from the book. Let's move to the point where Penn actually gets a colony. How did it come to be?
Well, we were talking about his father a few minutes ago, and the story that, as the story is generally told, his father had a debt owed to him by the crown. When his father was active in the Navy and on the Navy board, and had apparently put some of his own funds forward to feed the troops at some point, feed the sailors. And so his father had died 10 years ago, and Penn sort of decided to parlay this debt into territory in America. Now, the king didn't have to pay back the debt really at all. I mean, he was the king. But there was this very close connection, again, between Penn's father and then through his father to Penn. And like I said, he managed to kind of leverage himself a really significant grant of land based on this 10,000, it was 10,000 pounds, as he claimed, had then with interest and so on over the past decade. So he works this really interesting connection that he had with his father, and finds himself with a pretty significant land grant.
So what did Penn envision for Pennsylvania?
Well, he used a phrase that became very famous, the holy experiment. I talk a little bit in the book how it's not entirely clear what this means. It's not clear whether he meant by the word experiment what we mean by the word experiment. But it certainly was something that had been informed by his experiences, both as a persecuted Quaker in England. He had spent a good deal of time in Ireland in his youth, where his father had gained some lands as a result of his military service. He had traveled through Germany and Holland and seen a variety of different dissenting religious communities who were living in various places there. So he had an extraordinary sort of range of vision about the ways in which political loyalty and political unity could coexist with religious diversity. And that really was the controversial kind of hypothesis that he was hoping to vindicate through his colonizing enterprise.
Now, there were a number of documents. There's the charter itself, which, as you mentioned, will be on display Sunday at the State Museum. You can see the original charter. But fundamental constitutions, 1682 frame. But I want to read something to the audience here from the book where Penn, this is something that was important to him. But think about it in today's terms, too. But remember, we're talking about the 1680s. These were what was forbidden. All such offenses against God, as swearing, cursing, lying, profane talking, drunkenness, drinking of healths, obscene words, incest, sodomy, rapes, whoredom, fornication, and other uncleanness, all treasons, misprisons, murders, duels, felonies, seditions, maims, forcible entries, and other violence to the persons and estates of the inhabitants within this province, all prizes, stage plays, cards, dice, May games, gamesters, masks, revels, bull baitings, cock fightings, bear baitings, and the like, which excite the people to rudeness, cruelty, looseness, and irreligion, shall be respectively discouraged and severely punished. Doesn't sound like it was a fun time in Pennsylvania.
Yes, well, that's quite a list. You're right. In Penn's view, I mean, and you wouldn't be wrong if you thought he was a bit dour, a bit of a dour killjoy. As he would understand it, what religious freedom meant was the freedom to be religious. And the freedom to be religious in whichever way an individual became persuaded God was calling them to be. And that long list of things you mentioned there, some of which strike us as appropriately outlawed and some of which strike us as kind of an odd, jangling list, in Penn's view, what you wanted to do was set up your society in such a way that it made it as likely as possible that as many people as possible were going to find their way to God, not to find their way away from God, and not to come to Pennsylvania thinking it was some place to have a nonstop party. Now, again, the parameters of what we consider to be acceptable conscientious behavior, of course, have expanded over the years, but it does give you a sense of the degree to which a deep religious piety fired Penn's commitment to religious liberty and drew certain very stark borders around it.
I'm most curious about that bear baiting part. don't exactly know what that is, but religious freedom in Pennsylvania. I mean, when we talked earlier about the criticisms of Catholicism, one of the things that Penn kind of changed his outlook on was that, you know, Catholics could practice their religion. You kind of touched on this here in Pennsylvania, and other religions could as well. But there was a big asterisk there. Christians, only Christian religions, correct?
Well, in terms of being eligible to hold public office, those who acknowledge the existence of God. So, again, this was, as I said a minute ago, was a freedom to be religious. It wasn't atheism was still considered to be far beyond the pale, and that continued for quite some time. So, the question of civil liberty to practice religion on the one hand versus office holding was restricted to Christians, especially in the early years. And of course, Quakers considered themselves to be the true Christians. But you saw from the beginning an enormous range of different groups coming over to the colony. You have the origins of Germantown and the Welsh around Philadelphia and so on. But yes, it was. But from our perspective, it was still a fairly narrow band. Of course, from the perspective of the places where many of those people would be coming from, it was an enormous expansion.
Many probably think of that famous painting of Penn meeting with Native Americans and trading going on. My guess is that there are many Pennsylvanians, I have to admit that I did, thinking that the only people who were living here in Pennsylvania or what became Pennsylvania were the Native Americans. But that's not the case. There were Swedes already here, Dutch, some British already here. So, you know, what were these people thinking when this new guy comes in and, you know, the King of England says, all right, here's the guy, it's his colony now?
Right. Well, they were especially those groups, Dutch, Finns, Swedes, Germans and so on, were especially populous in the lower counties, you know, currently Delaware. So what you had developed very quickly was a Quaker elite in Philadelphia, which was then sort of ruling over these largely non-Quaker lower counties, and that led to all sorts of problems. It led eventually, early in the 18th century, to the separation of the lower counties and eventually the formation of Delaware as its own distinct colony. So there was conflict from the beginning. There was also conflict within the Quakers themselves. It's no surprise, I think, that any group of people is going to have this kind of tendency to, no matter how agreed they may be on religion, to have all sorts of practical difficulties come up. So it was not the peaceful kingdom that that Penn envisioned, not from the very beginning, but certainly not the longer things went along.
How did Penn get along with the Native Americans?
Well, I think there's an interesting and complicated story there. Of course, the myth, which most of us, including myself, as a native Pennsylvanian, was raised with, is that there was a famous treaty under the Treaty Elm and everything was wonderful. When you look at Pennsylvania in comparison to, say, Virginia or New England, where there was, you know, real carnage from early on, we don't have that, and I think that's something that's worth pointing out and worth sort of valuing. That said, he did sell their land. He wanted to buy it, but there wasn't ever really any question that he claimed the land as his own because the King of England had given it to him. So I think it's a complicated story with some caveats. I think it's a more peaceful situation than you saw in some other places, but it's not without a certain kind of moral complexity to it.
Okay, so let's talk about Penn's debts. You touched on this a little bit, but I have to admit that from reading the book, the guy was constantly in debt. It doesn't sound like he could handle money very well.
Well, it makes it sort of ironic, to say the least, that the colony became so was thriving for so long, became a lot of people got rich out of Pennsylvania. William Penn was not one of them. Though he had been in debt for quite some time, he was never good at balancing. He was never good at cutting his expenses. And he and his first wife, Guglielma, they sold some of her land, which raised them some money, but then they didn't get the rent from that land. So it was, in addition to being bad with expenses, he also had a really harmful tendency to sign papers without reading them, which is how he finds himself deeply in debt to his colleague, his agent, Philip Ford, and he ends up in debtor's prison for 9 months in 1708.
Yeah, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but William Penn was behind bars several times, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Although the debtor's prison was not for being a Quaker; it was for being for not paying his debts.
Mm. How often was he in prison for being a Quaker compared to not paying his debts?
Yeah, he spent three or four times, really in the first 3 or 4 years as a Quaker in the late 1660s and early 1670s. After that, he doesn't find himself in jail. He's more of a public figure, but he keeps himself out of jail. He does find himself paying a few fines at various points, But the Quakers have a sort of an active legal defense team that's working as well. George Fox, who's the founder of Quakerism, spends months and months and months in jail, and Penn is one of the people trying to get him out. So with regard to the debtor's prison, that was 1708, so he's well advanced. He's already been to Pennsylvania twice at that point, and he spends 8 months there. It's humiliating to him, but he gets out of debtor's prison basically by borrowing money from other people to pay back the people who put him in debtor's prison.
Mm.
So it all continues.
Payday loans. Vince is in Lebanon. Vince, I don't know whether Dr. Murphy could answer this or not, but you have a question about the Union Canal. Vince, are you there? Well, Vince, his question...
I probably wouldn't have been able to answer.
Okay, I didn't think so. He wanted to know if you had any information about building a canal statewide.
No, I'm afraid I don't.
Okay. We're almost out of time. Dr. Murphy, I want to thank you very much for being with us today. So,
my pleasure.
In hindsight, and I know I'm asking you to do this quickly, but what is William Penn's legacy other than just being the founder of Pennsylvania?
Well, I think that the ethnic and religious diversity that you see in the middle colonies, whether it's New Jersey, he was involved in the founding of New Jersey as well, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware. I mean, that's in some ways maybe not his personal legacy, but a legacy that he did a lot to foster and to continue. Ethnic and religious racial diversity also leads to, of course, religious diversity. So I think we're still living in the aftermath of the conditions that he helped set in place.
Dr. Andrew Murphy is author of the new book, William Penn, A Life. Dr. Murphy will be speaking about William Penn at the State Museum in Harrisburg this Sunday, Charter Day, at 2 p.m. And we had a question from a listener of whether there's a cost. And no, on Charter Day, it is free to get into the State Museum. Dr. Murphy, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Be sure to listen to Smart Talk coming up on Monday. We discuss a local group of medical professionals and volunteers who started a surgical outreach program, helping people with limited access to care overseas. And this is in a lot of what they're doing is in some of the poorest places on the planet. So be sure to tune in. A lot of these medical professionals are local. Looking forward to that program on Monday. Also, visit our website to get an outlook of conversations we're working on. You can leave a voicemail or a voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. Welcome back to Smart Talk. You know, today is, and maybe you knew this, maybe you did not, but today is the International Day of the Woman, and many women will be described in terms like superheroes. It's true that most superheroes in comic books or movies are men, but a recent study showed that when a super is female, the impact on young girls is measurable. Catwoman, Black Widow, and Supergirl are known to most, and soon Carol Danvers, also known as Captain Marvel, will explode onto the scene. What will happen with Marvel's mightiest Avenger when she makes her debut on the big screen? I assume that is coming up this weekend. Joining us to talk about women who are superheroes, Dr. Melissa Whaler, Dean of Humanities and Sciences at Central Penn College. Dr. Whaler publishes on topics such as feminism, performance, and the explosion of strong female characters in popular culture. Dr. Whaler, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So this film, Captain Marvel, with a female lead, is getting a lot of attention. I mean, because it is one of the first women who is a superhero, at least playing Captain Marvel.
Yes.
But why else? Why is the – it seems as though in popular culture, and even those not interested in pop culture, are very interested in this.
Yeah. So when we look at sort of the history of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, it goes back to Iron Man. And we have a lot of movies, a lot of hype that comes out of this. And for, you know, over a decade now, people have been saying, well, this is great. We love the Avengers. We love Iron Man. But where's the women? And these kind of movies, I think, really ask us to have ourselves reflected in those kind of films is very important. And we want to see that part of us reflected. And when we look at Captain Marvel, I think part of the excitement about her is that she's not Wonder Woman. She's something other than maybe we're mostly used to. I mean, we're used to sort of the big Avengers, we're used to the Justice League, and now we're getting this other female character in the guise of Captain Marvel. She is she's a captain. She's military. She's got paramilitary experience. She's not coming to us in a leotard. She's got a flight suit. She looks very much the part, and she has a compelling backstory that allows us to sort of see ourselves reflected in that character. I always say, you know, I would love to be Wonder Woman someday, but I'm not going to be an Amazonian. I'm not the daughter of a god. I'm not going to become a goddess. But could I become, a pilot? Could I get that kind of training? Absolutely, I could do that, you know. And so seeing ourselves reflected, I think, is so important. We haven't really had that, a female-led superhero film in this way. Plus, now that Marvel's owned by Disney, we're seeing it everywhere. It's the advertisement for this is just unbelievable.
There is a lot of hype surrounding it. So traditionally, as I said in the introduction, superheroes have been men, with the exception of a few. I don't know whether I call Catwoman a superhero or not. I mean,
complicated.
It is complicated. Yeah. She was a criminal, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, and a nemesis to Batman.
Yeah.
But anyway, so because this is so non-traditional, will it be accepted?
You know, and that's a really hard question. We saw with the Wonder Woman movie as the first major production of the two Marvel DC universes as a female-led film, we really saw a lot of backlash leading up to after the film as well. And we're already seeing that with Captain Marvel. Rotten Tomatoes had to change the way that they do their film reviews because it was getting what is called review bombed. So that's people who haven't seen the film that are going and reviewing the film and giving it bad ratings. And we saw that with Wonder Woman. We saw that with Star Wars, and we saw that with Captain Marvel. And mostly that's because we're now forefronting diversity in those films. And so those films became targets. I think it's a very complicated question because this representation is going to have backlash for a variety of reasons, right? I love fans because they're so passionate. And I just want that passion to kind of be channeled in more productive ways than going and poorly reviewing a film that hasn't even been released yet.
Right, exactly. I mean, that drives me crazy when someone has, because I mean, we even get that from time to time.
Absolutely.
When we talk about a topic, people make up their minds ahead of time before they have heard the program, or in this case, seen the film, you know, and you can't just base it on those commercials that you've seen. You're seeing a very small snippet of that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that it's easy to say, and probably quite accurate to say, that there's some sexism at work there, but is it more sexism, or is it those who have grown up with a tradition and you're changing that tradition? Maybe a bit of both.
Yeah, I think you can't divorce the two is what I would say to that. And in terms of sort of the sexism, it's really interesting because when we saw Wonder Woman, it was very much like, we don't need this. This is a bad movie. You know, why does she need a standalone movie? With Captain Marvel, the conversations become more coded, and that's because our cultural conversation around female superheroes has become more coded, I think. It's not okay just to come out and say, I'm not going to go see this because this is a movie with a female-led superhero. Now what's being said is, this isn't being marketed towards me. I'm not their audience. They don't care about me coming to see the film. So when you look at the reviews and you're on social media, that's what's coming out. What is really being coded there is, I don't want to see this movie because the woman is the lead. So again, it's this predetermination of the quality of the film. And it just dropped last night. Only a handful of people who went to the midnight screenings have even seen it outside of the pre-screeners. So the idea that everybody has all these opinions based on a trailer is ludicrous, right? And so there has to be something more there than what a 3-minute trailer can show you. So I don't think you can really divorce the two, which is a shame, because I hope people aren't being turned away because they see these negativity through the reviews and the advertisements.
You know, one of the big things about this, one of the parts of it that will be so interesting and fascinating to watch, is the influence it has on young girls and mm-hmm. and women.
Yeah.
You study this all the time.
Yeah.
What kind of influence do you think that Captain Marvel with a female lead yeah. will have?
Yeah. So I'll speak to my own experience. My own entrance. I grew up in a very small town in a rural part of Pennsylvania. We didn't have a bookstore, let alone a comic book store. So the only times I saw any kinds of superheroes being represented was on the television, which I was very lucky. I grew up during the age of the animated television. The original animated Batman, the original animated X-Men, all of these things were in sort of the cultural zeitgeist at the time. So I got to see a lot of female representation because that happened to be what was happening on television. So the X-Men is really famous for being very diverse. You have Storm, you have Rogue, you have Jean Grey, and these were the women that I grew up thinking about. Wonder Woman wasn't really available to me in my small town. And some of your listeners, especially if they're younger, are thinking, you know, how is that possible? How did you not have a comic book store or a bookstore? Because now you can order anything you want.
And there was no internet, right?
Yeah, so there was nothing. There was just the TV and me. Now that there is access, that's wonderful for young women. You had to kind of, for fans at my age, especially in my geographic location, you had to kind of parse out the women characters. You had to say, okay, this, you know, here's one here, here's one here, and you kind of had to put them together. You know, it's my hope that women who are going and taking young girls and dads, I hope the dads aren't just taking the boys to these movies. I hope they're taking their daughters and sharing that part of this culture with them because it is powerful. I went to go see Wonder Woman when it came out, and I've watched it since with women. And the energy in the room was like, oh my gosh, you know, we can go and kick some butt now. Like, you know, let's find some Nazis. Let's go beat them up. And I think that that's really important because, you know, if you grow up in your whole life and you're being told only if you have these very special circumstances, only if you are the most special person can you have these kind of powers, that's a really hard lesson. Whereas, you know, men and young boys are getting it from almost every angle. They're seeing themselves and their stories and their abilities reflected everywhere they go. So, my experience has been that was a way for me to see myself and what I could become. Now, of course, I'm not going to walk into some Terrigen gas anytime soon and get superpowers or have some sludge jumped on me. But it was
you don't know that yet. You're not out of the studio, you know?
I don't know what's happening in the studio. I know you guys are doing some renovations. Is it a superhero chamber? And I think that that's part of it. Like, seeing yourself reflected is just so important. That representation does matter. And I know that's become sort of a flip thing to say in popular culture. Representation matters, but it really does. And I think the next fight for people who want to see representation is not just, I love Wonder Woman, I love Supergirl, I love Jessica Jones, I love Captain Marvel. They're white women. I would love to see additional diversity brought to that, and not in the form of aliens. I get that all the time. Well, you know, there's aliens. There's, you know, beings who exist beyond, you know, our spectrum of ethnicity, race, gender, et cetera, et cetera. Love it. Love every part of that. Let's also see the people that, you know, walk down the street the same as I do every day.
I can't help thinking, though, about Black Panther.
Yes.
Which
yes.
a lot of the same things yes. were said about Black Panther yes. when it came out and, you know, became one of the most honored movies over the past year that there is.
Yeah.
But a lot of what you're talking about with diversity,
yes.
a lot of these things were said about Black Panther as well.
Yeah. And, you know, this whole idea that things can't get made because they don't have an audience, I mean, that's long been an excuse. Well, we don't want to make a film with a diverse cast because that population that it's representing doesn't go to the movie theater. We don't want to make a movie with a female superhero because women don't go to the theater to watch superhero movies. It's all these narratives that get creative about stereotypes, about who's watching and who's really consuming these things, and they're wrong. I mean, you know, Wonder Woman blew out the box office. I highly suspect Captain Marvel will do the same.
I have a feeling will too.
And same thing with Black Panther. And so this narrative in Hollywood and this narrative among fandoms that if you have a diverse cast, that it's not going to be successful. I think we're seeing time and time again. The question for me really is, when do we have to stop proving it? When does it become this narrative that we've created just simply isn't true? And now we don't have to constantly be coming over these barriers to get to having movies with representation. So really trying to unpack that narrative that seems to be false with each new movie that has representation and is really popular.
Now, you know, something you said a little bit earlier struck me. You said about this Captain Marvel is a superhero, a woman that is not in a leotard. Let's face it. Superheroes, even the men,
yep.
You know, they're built pretty well.
Yep.
They're, you know, very attractive men
sure
for
thing.
The most part. The women have always dealt with this, have the people looking at their appearance.
Yeah.
I mean, I think back to the Wonder Woman TV series, okay?
Of course.
Now, I was a teenager.
Of course, yeah.
And my first thought was not about the storyline going there, I have to admit.
Yeah.
You know? But as you said, now this Captain Marvel has a flight suit on.
She does, yeah.
Not exactly, you know, being portrayed like women have been portrayed as superheroes or part of those stories in the past.
Yeah, and you know,
now she's not unattractive. I will say that.
No, absolutely not. And so, yeah, I think that's always been an undercurrent for us when we study these characters, because you have to look at the whole trajectory, right? And we do have women who are being, once they enter the canon as superheroes. Now, early on, of course, they're in the canon, but they're in there as love interests, victims to be saved. They're not characters. They're very
Lois Lane.
Yeah, like a Lois Lane character.
Mm.
Always a Lois Lane character. Then you get Wonder Woman, right? And she comes out in this leotard. And there's been a lot of conversation about how appropriate or inappropriate it is when the new costume got created for the new Wonder Woman. It's not dissimilar from the Linda Carter years, right? But what's interesting is when the costume designers looked to create that, what they did is they went back and they looked at what Greek warriors were wearing and tried to simulate it so that there was theorization behind the costume, not just skimpiness for skimpiness' sake, right? Not just attractiveness for attractiveness' sake. And it is important to recognize that comic books, the history of comic books is they were written mostly by men, mostly for men. And so the costuming, you know, is in line with that, make them attractive and so that people will buy these things. And frankly, the Wonder Woman costume from the 70s isn't even the worst costume out there for women. There was a really bad time in the comics in the 90s where they were creating adult lines for the comic books for the young boys and the teenagers who got older who still wanted to read comic books. The costumes from the 90s get incredibly more, I would say, inappropriate. Now, what is important, I think, when we talk about superhero costumes is not that, you know, do the women often have, you know, certain areas exposed, your breasts, your buttocks, yes. And what people say to me is, well, superhero wears underwear. Superman wears underwear on the outside of his leotard, so he's also poorly dressed. Yes. The difference is when we see female superheroes is that that men are their costume shows off their physicality, whereas women it shows off their sexuality, and that's really a huge difference. So men will have tight leggings, whereas women will have bare legs. Men will have tight shirts on, but women will have no shirts or bodices, as you see with Wonder Woman. So yeah, the issue of superhero costuming and Supergirl, for those of you who watch the CW show, she does a whole montage where she tries on different superhero costumes, one more skimpy than the next, and she said, "Oh, how could I wear such a thing to go fight crime?" She's like, "This would fall off of me." And so they make it into a joke, but it is a reality. Some of these costumes you would never go out and fight crime in because they would fall off of you or something would fall out. So.
Exactly. We only have a minute or so left and really enjoyed this conversation. So for those who are going to see Captain Marvel
yes.
this weekend, what should they be thinking about? What would you like people to take away from it?
I want people who go to it to just really enjoy it. And if this is your 50th superhero movie or event, I want you to go in there and I want you to see something new, something fresh, maybe something different than what you previously experienced. If you have never seen a superhero movie, don't let that stop you. Go out, because this movie, I think, will be a great entry point into the universe, into the fandom. Come join me, be a fellow nerd, geek, whatever you claim is your title. And enjoy that experience. And please, if you're going, take friends and make it an experience that is shared, because seeing a powerful woman on the screen is such an important and unfortunately all too rare occurrence. So, you know, go into it, enjoy it. It is a superhero film. Parts of it, I certainly take some of those themes seriously, but also it's fun and it's okay to have fun with things. Yeah.
Dr. Melissa Whaler is Dean of Humanities and Science at Sciences at Central Penn College. Dr. Whaler, thank you very much for being with us
today.
Thank
you for having me.
Sounds like we have a lot of people who could be having some fun by going to the movies this weekend as well. So enjoy yourselves, whether you're going to the movies, whether you're going to the State Museum or the some of the other state historical sites for Charter Day, which are free this weekend. Be sure to have a good time. Coming up on Monday, we'll talk about some local surgeons who have been going overseas, some of the poorest countries in the world, for treatment.